No lights, no shadows. At what time did you finish writing? He asks.
I finished at 11:15, she says.
You're sure about that?
Yes, Greer says. I made myself stop because I didn't want to be tired today.
So after you finished writing, you went to bed. Say, 11:30?
Around then, yes.
Something about Greer Garrison's answers bothers him. They're too neat, too crisp. It's as though she has thought them through in advance. Nick takes a gamble.
Would you bring me to the computer, please, Miss Garrison? He asks.
I don't see why that's necessary.
I would like to see it.
Well then, I shall go fetch it for you.
No, you misunderstood me, Nick says. I would like you to bring me to the computer.
That's an unreasonable request, Greer says.
I've got her, he thinks. It's an unreasonable request for you to bring me to the computer, but not for you to bring the computer to me? Because there's something you want to delete or hide on the computer?
Not at all, Greer says.
Fine. Then bring me to the computer. Please, Miss Garrison.
She stares at him for a beat, then she rises. Nick follows Greer down the hall. They step through an arched doorway into an anteroom. There's a niche built into the wall that holds an enormous bouquet of hydrangeas and lilies, and Greer opens a door. There's a sitting room with a sofa, a love seat, antique tables, and a desk that faces out a window. The view out the window is of the side yard of a fence and the top of the pool house. Through a connecting door, Nick sees the master bedroom. There's a king bed made up with white sheets and a comforter, and an assortment of pillows, all of them neatly arranged. A cashmere blanket embroidered with the word Summerland is draped on the diagonal across the corner of the bed. Nick blinks. Greer found the time to make her bed so artfully after she found out Merritt was dead, or before. But at that moment, a woman pops out of the master bath holding a bucket and a roll of paper towels. The housekeeper.
You'll excuse us, please, Elida, Greer says.
Elida nods and scurries away.
Does Elida live here? Nick asks.
She does not, Greer says. She works 7 to 5. Today she came a bit earlier because of the wedding.
Nick follows Greer over to a simple mahogany desk, gleaming as though just polished. On the desk are a laptop, a legal pad, 3 pens, a dictionary, and a thesaurus. There's a Windsor chair at the desk, and Nick takes a seat and turns his attention to the computer.
So this here, a slayer in Santorini, is the piece you were working on last night?
Yes, Greer says.
It says you closed it at 12:22 a.m. But you told me 11:15.
I stopped writing at 11:15. I closed the document at 12:22, apparently.
But you said you went right to bed. You said you went to bed around 11:30.
I did go to bed, Greer says. But I had difficulty falling asleep, so I had a drink.
Of water?
No, a drink. I had a glass of champagne.
So, sometime between 11:15 and 12:22 a.m., you went to the kitchen for a glass of champagne?
Yes.
And did you notice any activity then?
Greer pauses. I did not.
You didn't see anyone? Nick says.
Well, on my way back to my room, I saw my daughter-in-law, Abby. She was going to the kitchen for water.
She was?
Yes.
Why didn't she get water from the bathroom?
She wanted ice, is my guess. She's pregnant, and it was a warm night.
Did you and Abby have a conversation?
A brief one.
What did she say to you?
She said she was waiting for Thomas to get home. He had gone out with Benji and the others.
Ah, yes. Nick recalls that Abby was annoyed that Thomas had decided to go out.
Anything else?
Not really, no.
Did you see anyone else?
No.
And after you got your champagne, you returned to your bedroom to sleep? Nick asks.
That's right.
Nick pauses to scribble down notes. She lied to him 10 minutes ago. There's no reason to believe another word she says.
Let me switch gears here.
We found a 2-person kayak overturned on your beach. Do you own such a kayak?
It belongs to my husband, Greer says.
She cocks her head.
It was left overturned on the beach, you say?
Yes. Does that seem odd to you?
She nods slowly. A bit.
And why is that?
Tag is fanatical about his kayaks, Greer says. He doesn't leave them just lying about.
Is it possible that someone else used the kayak?
No, he keeps them locked up. If the 2-person kayak was left out, then he must have taken someone out on the water. If he were going out alone, he would have taken his 1-person kayak.
Any idea who he might have taken out?
Greer shakes her head.
She looks far less confident than she did a moment ago, and Nick feels her losing her grip on the explanation she had so neatly written in her mind.
I suppose you'll have to ask my husband that, she says.
Wednesday, May 30th to Tuesday, June 19th, 2018. Tag. He takes Merritt's number but makes no plans to see her again. It's a one and done, a weekend fling, which is how he likes to keep things with other women. There have been half a dozen or so over the course of his marriage, one or two nightstands, women he never sees or thinks of again. His behavior has nothing to do with how he feels about Greer. Or maybe it does. Maybe it's an assertion of power, of defiance. Greer entered the marriage with more money and higher social standing. Tag has always felt a touch inferior. The prowling around is how he balances the scales. When he gets back to New York, 2 things happen. One is that Sergio Ramon calls. Tag considers letting the call go to voicemail. He fears that Sergio has learned that he took Merritt to the wine dinner, and he's calling to express his disapproval. But then Tag reminds himself that taking Merritt to the dinner was done with Greer's blessing.
Hello, Tag says. Sergio, how are you?
It turns out that Sergio is calling for a very different reason. His contact at Skadden Arps has told Sergio that there's grumbling within the litigation department about Thomas Winbury. He isn't pulling his weight, apparently. He takes long lunches and unscheduled vacation days. He often leaves work at 5 o'clock when other associates stay until 9 or 10 at night. At his last review, he was given a warning, but he's shown no improvement. There's talk of letting him go. Tag sighs. Thomas has always put in just enough work to get by. Abby's family is so wealthy that Tag suspects Thomas wants to get fired. He'll work for Mr. Freeman in the oil business. He'll move to Texas, which will break Greer's heart.
Thanks for the heads up, Sergio, Tag says. I'll have a talk with him.
He hangs up before Sergio can ask him how the wine dinner was, and then he swears at the ceiling. A few nights later, Thomas and Abby come for dinner at Tag and Greer's apartment. Greer has made a leg of lamb, and the apartment is redolent with the smell of roasting meat, garlic, and rosemary. But as soon as Abby enters the apartment, she covers her mouth with her hand and bolts for the bathroom. Thomas shakes his head.
I guess she's gone and ruined the surprise, he says. We're pregnant again.
Greer reaches out for Thomas, but they all know to limit their reaction to cautious optimism. Tag shakes Thomas's hand, then pulls him in for a hug and says,
You'll make one hell of a father.
No sooner are the words out of his mouth than Tag doubts their veracity. Will Thomas make a hell of a father? He needs to buckle down at work, start setting an example. Tag nearly brings Thomas into his study to tell him as much, but he decides in the end to let the occasion be a happy one, or as happy as it can be with a woefully sick Abby. He'll talk to Thomas another time. That night, Tag can't sleep. He slips from bed and goes into his study. His 3 home studies, the one in New York, the one in London, and the one on Nantucket, are sanctuaries dedicated to Tag's privacy.
No one enters without permission except the cleaning ladies. Tag takes out his phone and scrolls for Merritt's number. She answers on the third ring. Hey, Tag. Her voice brings it all back. There is noise in the background, voices, music. She's out somewhere. It's 2 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday night. Tag should not be pursuing this. Hey yourself, he says. I hope I didn't wake you. She laughs. I'm downtown at this speakeasy thing. It looks like a laundromat, but there's a secret door, a code word, and voila! You enter the underworld. Do you want to come join me? I'll tell you how to get in. No, thank you, Tag says. I just called to tell you your instincts were correct. Abby is pregnant. She and Thomas told us tonight at dinner. Who? Merritt says. Abby. Abby, my daughter-in-law. She was with you during Celeste's bachelorette weekend. You said... Oh, that's right, Merritt says. Abby. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Tag feels like a fool. He should hang up. He's going to see Merritt in a few weeks at the wedding, and it would be best if their dalliance were a thing of the past. But there is something about this girl. He can't leave it alone. Where did you say your apartment is? He asks. I think I've forgotten. Tag sees Merritt the next day after work, and the day after that. And on Saturday, he tells Greer he's going to run in Central Park, but instead he goes to Merritt's apartment. After sex, they walk down the street to a really good sandwich place and order lunch and sit side by side and talk and laugh. And in the middle of it, Tag realizes that he is losing control of the situation. What is he doing? Anyone might see him here with this girl. He walks Merritt back to her apartment and she pulls him in by the front of the shirt. She wants him to come inside. And he wants to. Oh, does he want to? He agrees, but just for a minute, he says. She has turned him into a teenager again. His desire is so intense, so relentless, it frightens him. He can't remember wanting anyone or anything as much as he wants this girl. His feelings for Greer seem almost quaint by comparison. Merritt is 28 years old, nearly 29. She has a lukewarm relationship with her brother, and she doesn't speak to her parents at all. This Tag can't understand. What do you do on Thanksgiving? He asks. Christmas. She shrugs. Last year, Thanksgiving was Chinese food and a movie. On Christmas, I flew to Tulum for a yoga retreat. Tag senses a hole inside of Merritt, an emotional hole, which he knows is very, very dangerous. He needs to end this thing now, while there is still time to recover before the wedding. But the attraction grows stronger. Soon, he thinks only of Merritt, when he's working, when he's exercising, when he and Greer are eating dinner at Rosa Mexicano. Greer is consumed with finishing her novel and planning Benji's wedding. She is so focused on these two projects that she doesn't notice any change in Tag. She doesn't see him, she doesn't hear him, and sex is out of the question. She jokes that they'll have a second honeymoon once Benji and Celeste are on their first honeymoon. But Tag knows that once the wedding is over, Greer will collapse, exhausted. Or she'll go into a funk because there's nothing left to look forward to. He schedules a drinks meeting with clients at the bar at the Whitby Hotel, and he asks Merritt to go sit at this bar without letting on that she knows him. She does exactly as he asks, wearing a slinky black dress and 5-inch stilettos, and Tag excuses himself from his clients for a moment. He follows Merritt into the ladies' room, where they lock the door and have shockingly hot sex. When Tag walks out, he is so intoxicated he doesn't care who sees him. Later, he chastises himself for being reckless. He asks himself what he's doing. She is given tickets to see Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden. Will he go with her? I can't, he says. It's too risky. Please, she says. They're second row seats. That's the problem, he says. If they were nosebleed seats, I wouldn't worry about seeing anyone I know.
Fine, then, she says. I'll take Robbie.
Who's Robbie?
My on-again, off-again, Merritt says. He's the daytime bartender at the Breslin.
Tag is addled by news of Robbie's existence, although what did he expect? Naturally, there's a Robbie. He wouldn't be surprised if there were half a dozen Robbies. The thought is so dispiriting that the next day finds Tag at the bar of the Breslin at lunchtime, ordering the rabbit tureen and a scotch egg, at least it's a good place, from a big Irish hunk, Robbie. He has 6 inches and 40 pounds on Tag, plus he's 25 years younger. This is who Merritt should be dating. Not only is Robbie a bartender, he's an aspiring actor. An idle chit-chat reveals that he's just been cast in a pilot. Tag hates Robbie with a blood-red passion. He leaves him an absurdly large tip. The night of the concert, Tag is agitated. He imagines Robbie putting his shovel-sized hands on Merritt's waist and swaying to the music behind her. He's so unsettled by this vision that he tells Greer he isn't hungry for dinner. He might have a sandwich in his study later. He sends Merritt a text. Let me know when the concert is over. I'll meet you at your place. 20 fraught minutes later, he receives a text back. K. Has there ever been a less satisfying response in the short history of texting? Tag thinks not. 11 o'clock comes and goes. 11:30. Tag succumbs to his hunger and heads to the kitchen for a ham sandwich. He sees a light on in their bedroom. He opens the door to find Greer wearing her tailored blue pajamas. Her hair is in a bun held up with a pencil, and her reading glasses are perched on the end of her nose. There's a glass of Chardonnay to the right of her laptop. She's in the middle of a scene, he can tell, but she looks up and smiles.
Shall we go to bed, then? She asks.
Yes, Tag thinks. Say yes. Look how elegant his wife is. How productive, how ingenious. She's absolutely everything he could ever want in a woman. I need to keep going, Tag says. Ernie and I are putting that Libya deal together. It's going to be huge. He'll be at the office first thing in the morning, and I have to have the numbers waiting for him.
Greer shuts off her computer. Well, I'm calling it a night.
She raises her face for a kiss.
Don't stay up too late.
You know I won't, Tag says. Love you, darling. He waits until 12:30, and when there is still no text from Merritt, he sneaks out of the apartment, hails a taxi, and goes down to Perry Street. He stands outside her building and buzzes her apartment, but there's no answer. Then he hears her laugh. He looks down the street to spy Merritt and Robbie on approach. They're walking close together but not touching. Tag tries to hurry down the steps of the building before she sees him, but it's too late. Tag? She says. He's caught. It's nearly 1 a.m. There is no way to play this off as casual. He's a worldly successful man standing in front of a girl's apartment building like some schlub in a rom-com. If Greer could see him now, she would find him so absurd she might even laugh. But the sight of Merritt sends a surge of adrenaline through Tag. He feels enough passion to kick Robbie the lickspittle to the curb, despite his size advantage, and then carry Merritt up the stairs over his shoulder. She's wearing a white crocheted sundress and dangling earrings, and her hair is up. She's as fetching as any woman he's ever seen. I need to talk to you, he says.
Okay, Merritt says.
She looks up at Robbie.
Robbie, this is Tag.
Tag, Robbie. Tag extends a hand automatically. Robbie says, Weren't you in for lunch the other day? At the Breslin? Tag shouldn't have left such a big tip. It would have been impossible to forget. Were you? Merritt says. She looks amused. She now understands the power she has over him. He has made such a mess of things, he thinks. He should have just gone to the concert.
Merritt's birthday is June 18th. She wants to do something special. She wants to go away with Tag. Tag considers this request. Where would they go? To Paris? Rome? Istanbul? Los Angeles? Rio de Janeiro? He does some research on Istanbul, but decides flying overseas is impractical and risky, even if they do so separately. He books a hotel room in New York instead, at the Four Seasons downtown. He worries a bit because before he and Greer moved to New York, they used to stay at the Four Seasons in Midtown, and they like to stay at Four Seasons when they travel. But it's a brand he trusts, and it's only one night, and the hotel is all the way down by the Freedom Tower, which isn't a neighborhood that anyone he knows frequents after 5 o'clock. The weekend before Merritt's birthday, Tag and Greer are on Nantucket. Greer has a 3-hour meeting with Roger Pelton, the wedding planner. Tag goes for a ride in the kayak, then he drives into town to get lunch. He loves the soft-shell crab sandwich from Straight Wharf Fish, and while he's at it, he decides to buy Merritt a present. He has been trained by Greer to understand that the only acceptable present for a birthday or anniversary is jewelry. He walks into the Jessica Hicks boutique thinking he will get earrings or a choker, but when he describes the young woman he's buying for, he pretends the gift is for his daughter-in-law, Abby, who is pregnant with their first grandchild. Jessica shows him the silver ring with the lace pattern embedded with the multicolored sapphires. "It's meant to be worn on the thumb," Jessica says.
"The thumb?" Tag says.
"Trust me," Jessica says. "It's a thing." Tag buys the thumb ring and leaves the store feeling a sense of giddy anticipation. The ring is beautiful. Merritt will love it, he's certain. His happiness is a thing. On the 18th, Tag gets to the hotel early. He has had a bouquet of expensive roses delivered to the room, as well as champagne. He sets the box from Jessica Hicks between the flowers and the ice bucket. Everything is as it should be, but he can't relax. Something about this scenario makes him feel like a run-of-the-mill cheat. He's a stereotype, a middle-aged man sleeping with one of his daughter-in-law's friends because his wife is busy and distracted, and he needs to boost his self-esteem. He waits in the room for Merritt to arrive, but she texts to say she's at the salon getting a bikini wax and she'll be late. He's a bit turned off by her frankness. Is it necessary to tell him she's getting waxed? It feels inelegant. He decides to go down to the bar for a drink. A real drink. As soon as he walks into the bar, he locks eyes with a man. Then he realizes with horror that the man is his son, Thomas. Before Tag can think better of it, he ducks behind a pole. He waits a few seconds, not breathing, his heart skidding to a near stop as he waits for Thomas to confront him and ask what he's doing there. What should Tag say? Meeting a client for drinks, of course. And then when the client doesn't materialize, Tag can pretend to be annoyed and skip out to make a phone call. He waits. Nothing happens. Tag saw Thomas, but is it possible that Thomas didn't see Tag, or saw him but somehow didn't register the face as that of his father? Enough time passes that Tag decides to take action. He peers around the column. Thomas is staring into his highball glass. He looks miserable. As much as Tag realizes the urgency of him leaving the bar while he can, he's arrested by his elder son's demeanor. He thinks back to the phone call from Sergio. Thomas is leaving work early. Thomas is taking unscheduled vacations. And now here he is having a drink at a hotel bar at the far tip of Manhattan, which isn't anywhere close to his office. Tag wants to sit down next to Thomas and ask him what's going on. Maybe he's been fired? Maybe Abby lost the baby? If it's either of those, Tag will find out soon enough. He needs to get out of the bar undetected. He turns and hurries out, hoping Thomas won't recognize him from behind. He goes back up to the room for his bag and texts Merritt. Something came up. Room 1011 is yours for the night. There's champagne and a little gift for you. But I have to take a rain check. Sorry about that. Happy birthday, Parkway. Tag takes a taxi back uptown and walks into his apartment to find Greer in her yoga clothes, folded over in child's pose on the living room rug. She looks up and beams. You're home, she says. And just like that, the spell is broken. Tag is finished fooling around. He is back to being a dutiful husband, a steadfast father, and an expectant grandfather. Merritt calls in tears. She leaves messages, sends texts. She calls him a bastard. She tells him to stick a fork in his eye. Only that's not how she phrases it. She calls Tag's office and speaks to Miss Hillary, Tag's very proper, very British secretary, who is so devoted to Tag that she followed him over from London. Miss Parkway called? Miss Hillary says, handing Tag the message slip. She said it's urgent. Thank you, Miss Hillary, Tag says, with what he hopes is a carefree smile. He closes the door to his office and collapses at his desk. Merritt calling him at the office is one step away from Merritt calling the apartment, or, because Tag knows Celeste might naively give Merritt the number, calling Greer's cell phone. Well, she's going to get what she wants. Tag calls Merritt back. Tag? She says. What on God's green earth are you doing? He asks. You can't call me here. I'm pregnant, she says. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 12 o'clock p.m. Nantucket. By mid-morning, the entire island is buzzing with the news of the murdered maid of honor. Marty Skazerba calls his daughter, Laura Ray, initially just to hear the sound of her voice and to reassure himself that she is okay. But then he asks about Audie Conover. Is she okay? And Laura Ray says, Yes, Dad, obviously. What's wrong with you? Marty ends up spilling the whole story, or what he knows of it. Laura Ray tells her fiancé, Ty, who works for Toscana Excavating and who is as tight-lipped as they come. But Ty swings by his mother's house for a second breakfast, and he tells her the story. Carla, Ty's mother, volunteers at the hospital thrift shop Saturdays at noon, and she proceeds to tell every single person who walks in the door. Finn McAvoy gets a text from his girlfriend, Lola Budd, saying, I caught a murder suspect. Finn is at Cisco Beach giving surfing lessons to a group of overprivileged 8-year-olds who all want to be John Florence. Finn casually flings out the content of Lola's text. My girlfriend caught a murder suspect, he says. The next thing Finn knows, he is surrounded by the young surfer's mothers, and they're all talking about someone called the murdered maid of honor, and they ask Finn if the police had caught the guy and who it was. And Finn is sorry he ever opened his mouth. Finn's twin sister, Chloe McAvoy, has taken to her bed despite the fact that it's a hot, sunny summer Saturday and work that day has been canceled. Work has been canceled because Merritt Monaco, the maid of honor in the Otis Winbury wedding, is dead. Roger Pelton found her floating just off the beach earlier that morning. Siobhan had called to tell Chloe about the death herself instead of having Donna, the waitstaff manager, do it, because Siobhan is that kind of owner. She takes responsibility for her employees. Chloe, she said, the wedding has been canceled. Merritt Monaco, the maid of honor, passed away overnight. Passed away? She died, Chloe, Siobhan said. She's dead. She drowned out in front of the house last night. But, Chloe said, that's all we know for now, Siobhan said. The police are working on it. The police, Chloe thought. She had seen Uncle Ed out on the deck on his phone a short while earlier, but Uncle Ed was always on the phone. Chloe had hung up with Siobhan and closed her eyes. Chloe had been kept far away from death since she was 7 years old, when Uncle Ed and Auntie came to tell her and Finn that their parents were dead. Both of them at once, killed in a sailing accident. Chloe hadn't really gotten it then. She had been too young. What did she know of death at age 7? Not one thing. Her parents' death has gotten much worse for Chloe as she's grown older. Now she knows what she's missing. She has no father to treat her like a princess. She has no mother to rebel against. She does have Uncle Ed and Auntie, and they are strong, reliable, capable caregivers, but they aren't her parents. Whenever Chloe thinks about her father playing "Please Come to Boston" on his guitar, or her mother painting a rose on Chloe's cheek, she feels unbearably sad. She texted Blake, a girl who worked with her, "Merritt, the maid of honor, is dead." Blake texted back, "I know. I heard there was a lot of blood." Chloe ran to the bathroom to throw up. After the rehearsal dinner the night before, Chloe had a few beers with Blake and Geraldo. Geraldo is 24 years old, from El Salvador, and he always provides Chloe and Blake with post-shift alcohol. Uncle Ed had knocked on the door. "You okay in there?" "Fine," Chloe said. She wanted to ask Uncle Ed about Merritt, but she couldn't handle the conversation right that second. She cursed Geraldo. Now back in bed, Chloe revisits the events of the party. Most jobs go the same way. Chloe and her co-workers show up early in their immaculate black pants and crisp white shirts, showered, fresh-faced, ready to serve. Because she is only 16, Chloe can't serve alcohol, although this rule gets bent all the time. Nearly the first thing that happened at this rehearsal dinner was that Greer Garrison, the mother of the groom, asked Chloe for a refill of champagne. Chloe told Ian, the bartender, that he needed to serve Miss Garrison, but Ian was 3 deep, and he told Chloe to find Geraldo. But Geraldo wasn't around, and Greer Garrison sang out for a refill again with a pointed look at Chloe, so Chloe grabbed the Veuve Clicquot from the cooler and discreetly filled Miss Garrison's glass. Chloe didn't notice much else about the actual festivities, other than the guests growing drunker and drunker. There was a blackberry mojito punch, and the guests were inhaling it. Chloe cleared a bunch of half-empty punch cups with mint leaves and whole fat blackberries trapped among the melting ice. She brought them to the kitchen, where she found Geraldo manning the kitchen trash. He picked up the cup with the most punch and drank it. "Ew," Chloe said. "Someone else's mouth was on that. Also, if Siobhan sees you doing that, she'll fire you."
"Siobhan just left," Geraldo said. "She has 4 other events tonight. She won't be back."
"Donna, then," Chloe said, but they both knew Donna wasn't strict at all. If she saw Geraldo drinking, she would do no more than roll her eyes.
"Try it," Geraldo said.
"No," Chloe said.
"Just try it," Geraldo said.
Chloe had never been good at resisting peer pressure. Plus, the drink was a delicious-looking purple color. Chloe drank half a cup without letting her lips touch the rim. The drink was so fruity and minty that she could barely taste the alcohol, but almost instantly she felt lighter, more relaxed. She fell into the habit of sneaking a few sips of punch whenever she cleared. She wasn't getting drunk, she didn't think. If anything, the punch was making her more perceptive. Chloe wanted to be a writer like Greer Garrison. But she didn't want to write murder mysteries. She wanted to write a blog about fashion and lifestyle. What was new, what was hot. The great thing about this wedding in particular was how attractive and stylish everyone was. Chloe had mentally snapped pictures of at least 4 outfits, including the outstanding jumpsuit that Greer Garrison was wearing. She looked amazing, and she was in her 50s. When Chloe was heading back to the kitchen, there was a British woman at table 4 who demanded more biscuits. She smelled smoke, and as Greer had decreed, there was to be absolutely no smoking anywhere on the premises. Chloe decided the biscuits could wait, and she went in search of the source. She had found the maid of honor on the side porch, smoking a cigarette and ashing into the lace hydrangea bush below. Chloe was about to open her mouth to let her know smoke was blowing into the house when a man walked up the outside steps of the side porch. It was the groom's father. He took a drag off the maid of honor's cigarette, and he leaned his elbows on the railing next to her. Chloe should have gone back to work. If the father of the groom, who owned this house, sanctioned the smoking, then it must have been okay. But Chloe stayed plugged in right where she was. The maid of honor was cooler than cool. She wore a stretchy black tank dress with straps that crisscrossed and a very low dip in the back and a leather and crystal choker that Chloe thought could have come from Van Cleef & Arpels or could have been purchased at a flea market in Mumbai. It was impossible to tell, which was what made it cool. "You have to get rid of it," the father of the groom said. "I can't," the maid of honor said. "You can," the father of the groom said. "I won't." "Merritt, you don't want a baby." Chloe pressed her lips together. "I don't want a baby," Merritt said. "But I do want you. I want you, Tag. And this is your baby. It's my connection to you."
"I could call your bluff," Tag said. "How do I know the baby is mine? It could just as easily be Robbie's."
"I haven't slept with Robbie since last year," Merritt says, "and nothing happened a few weeks ago. You saw to that, didn't you?"
"How can I be sure you're really pregnant?
How do I know you haven't gotten rid of it already? Here you are smoking. If you're so set on having the baby, why not start taking care of it?" "It's none of your business what I do," Merritt said.
"Either it is or it isn't," Tag said. He flicked the cigarette into the lace hydrangea. "Make up your mind."
"Tag."
"We are going to get through this wedding," Tag said. "And when you leave on Sunday, I'll write you a check. But then that's it, Merritt. This is over."
Tag disappeared from Chloe's view. Down the stairs, she imagined, and back to the party.
"I'll tell Greer!" Merritt called out after him.
There was no response, and Merritt dissolved into tears. Chloe had the urge to comfort her, but at the same time she was thinking, what a scandal. The maid of honor was pregnant with the father of the groom's baby. He wanted her to get rid of it. She wanted to be with him. He wanted to pay her off. She threatened blackmail.
"Chica!"
Geraldo was gesturing from down the hall, and Chloe hurried toward him. She needed to get back to work. Despite what she had witnessed, or maybe because of it, Chloe continued to sneak drinks. It didn't seem to be affecting her work performance. She served the clam bake, cleared the clam bake. She half-listened to the toasts. She served dessert and then cleared dessert. People started to dance. Chloe looked for Merritt, the maid of honor, but didn't see her. Tag, meanwhile, was dancing with Greer. The party was coming to an end. The band played its final song, and Chloe switched into what she thought of as turbo clear mode. Anything not nailed down was going back to the kitchen. There had been champagne toasts, so there was a slew of slender flutes, which were more difficult to transport than punch cups because of their high center of gravity. Chloe tried to be mindful. It was dark, the terrain was uneven, and she had had no small amount of punch herself. She was carrying a full tray of flutes with varying levels of champagne remaining. Chloe was debating whether she should start drinking the champagne. Veuve Clicquot was very expensive, she knew, and she was also thinking of a musical instrument she had once seen that was nothing more than a collection of water glasses filled to different levels that some dude played with one wetted finger, when the toe of her clog caught the raised lip where the lawn met the beach. The tray went flying, the glasses shattered. The sound was one from the recurring nightmares of servers everywhere. Chloe cringed. She willed the tray to fly back up into her hands like a film in reverse, the glasses restored to whole. She was relieved that the party was ending, and no one seemed to have noticed her display of utter gracelessness. But then a voice came from out of the darkness. "Here, let me help." Chloe looked up from the wreckage. It was Merritt, the maid of honor, in her cool black dress.
"You don't have to," Chloe said. "It's my fault."
"Could have happened to anyone," Merritt said. "Would have happened to me, I assure you, if I'd been brave enough to do this job at your age." Chloe stared at Merritt for a second. She was intrigued and embarrassed now that they were face to face. Chloe knew Merritt's secret, but Merritt didn't know that Chloe knew. If Merritt had realized Chloe knew that she was pregnant with the groom's father's baby, she would have been, what, angry that Chloe eavesdropped? Mortified by the example she was setting? Chloe kept her face down so as not to give anything away in her expression. She picked the bigger shards out of the grass. They clinked on the tray.
"What's your name?"
Merritt asked.
"Chloe McAvoy."
"Where do you live, Chloe?"
"Here," Chloe said, "on Nantucket, year-round."
Merritt sighed. "Well then, you're the luckiest girl in the world."
"Where do you live?"
Chloe asked.
"I live in New York City," Merritt said.
"I work in PR there and I do some influencing stuff on Instagram."
"Oh," Chloe followed. "Really? What's your name? I'll follow you."
"At Merritt, 2 R's, 2 T's, Monaco, like the country. Can you remember that? I'd be honored if you followed me, Chloe. I'll keep an eye out and follow you back."
"You will?"
Chloe said. She felt insanely flattered. Merritt was an influencer, even as she knew she should not put Merritt on any kind of pedestal. If she ever got into the position Merritt was in, Auntie and Uncle Ed would be extremely disappointed. Still, she couldn't help but feel a bit of starstruck awe.
"I love your dress. Do you mind telling me who it's by?"
Merritt looked down as if to remind herself what she was wearing. "Young, fabulous, and broke," she said. "Which describes me." Her smile faded. "Well, 2 out of 3 anyway." Once the glass was all picked up and Merritt had hurried off to find Celeste, Chloe wanted to finish cleaning up and leave. She presented the tray of broken glass to Donna, who frowned but then said,
"Happens to the best of us, kid."
Geraldo said,
"Let's get out of here, chica."
Chloe had to go to the bathroom. Badly. Siobhan didn't like them to use the restrooms unless it was an absolute emergency, and this definitely qualified. There was a powder room designated for guests, and now that most of the guests had left, it was unoccupied. When Chloe emerged a few minutes later, she turned left down the hall toward what she thought was the front door and freedom. But the hall led her into a living room.
"Hey,"
a voice said. Chloe peered into the room but saw no one. Then, from a chair that looked like a scoop of vanilla ice cream, a woman sat up. It was the woman who had been so rude about the cheddar biscuits and had sent Chloe in search of more. "And see that they are warm."
"Hello?"
Chloe said.
"Can you bring me a bottle of something, dollface?"
the woman said.
"Whiskey? Vodka? Some of that champagne Greer was drinking?"
Chloe said.
"The party is over, actually."
"The official party is over,"
the woman said. She had a bad dye job, blonde turning a rust color at the part.
"Now is the after party, and as I've run dry, I need your help."
"I'm only 16, Chloe said. "I can't serve alcohol. It's against the law."
The woman laughed.
"Ha ha. What if I gave you £100? Or wait, 100... What do you Yanks call them? Bucks!"
$100? It was tempting. Chloe knew how easy it would be to pluck a bottle from the boxes waiting to go back out to the catering truck. But she thought of Merritt. One wayward decision might lead to another, she feared.
I'm sorry, Chloe said. I have to get home.
Sweetie, please, the woman said. I'm desperate. I would have bet my last shilling that Tag Winbury kept scotch in every room, but I can't find a drop. And you are the catering help, aren't you? So it's your job to bring me what I want.
I'm sorry, Chloe said. I'm off the clock. I'm leaving now.
She gave the woman what she hoped was a professional smile and turned around. She headed back the way she'd come and zipped out the side door of the house. Because really, how much could she be expected to deal with in one night? Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 12:30 p.m. The chief. He has to drive from Monomoy to the station, where they're holding Shooter Uxley. He has two state policemen back at the scene to make sure nothing is tampered with and no one else flees. He could use two more guys, quite honestly. Nantucket just isn't equipped for a murder during a busy holiday weekend. That is the stark truth. The chief inhales through his nose and exhales through his mouth. His takeaway from the stress management course he's required to attend every 3 years. He'll question Shooter himself, and that will likely shed some light on things. He'll hear from the ME about an exact cause of death. If he still hasn't figured out what happened, he has the father, the brother, and the groom himself. But frankly, the chief likes the best man for this. Why else would he run? Then again, after he'd disappeared last night, why would he come back? What is going on here? The chief talked to Nick briefly before he left the compound. Nick said the mother of the groom, Greer Garrison, the mystery writer, had misled him about her timetable. Intentionally, he thinks. I didn't like the way our interview went, Nick said. It had a funny smell. The chief calls home. Andrea answers.
How's it going?
Oh, fine, Ed says. Andrea will know he means the exact opposite. He wants to tell Andrea that Finn's girlfriend, Lola Budd, was the one who ended up finding their main suspect. It's a good story, and it will hearten Andrea to know that Lola has had a chance to shine, but there isn't time to get into it now. How's Chloe? The chief asks. Is her stomach feeling any better? Not sure, Andrea says. She's locked herself in her room. No locked doors, Ed says. This has been a rule since back when his own kids, Casey and Eric, were growing up. You come home and tell her that, Andrea says, because I've tried and she won't budge. She's upset about the girl. The murdered maid of honor, everyone is calling her now. Everyone? Ed asks. Is it that bad already? People talking? People giving the story a name? We aren't even sure she was murdered. Not sure at all. It's a small island, Ed, Andrea says. She pauses, and he realizes she has just lobbed his favorite line right back at him. Would it be awful if, while you were out solving this murder, I went to the beach? He's investigating a murder, not solving anything. Go to the beach, he says, but please be careful.
You're sweet, Andrea says.
Love you. He hangs up just as a call comes in from Cape Cod Hospital. This is Ed Cappanash, he says.
Chief, it's Linda.
Linda Ferretti, the medical examiner.
Prelims indicate our girl died by drowning around 3 a.m. The blood work shows someone slipped her a Mickey, or maybe she self-medicated. A barbiturate seems to be the culprit. The cut on her foot was the source of all that blood, but it was just a surface wound. She has one fingerprint-sized bruise on her wrist. My best guess is someone yanked her or pulled on her arm. There are no other signs that she was strangled or smothered and then dumped. She either took pills or was given something. She went out for a swim, passed out, drowned. Could have happened in a bathtub.
Okay, the chief says. What was her blood alcohol content?
Low, Linda says. 0.025.
Really? The chief says.
You're sure?
Surprised me too at first, she says. The contents of her stomach were minimal. Either she didn't eat much last night, or, what I think is more likely, she vomited up what she did eat.
What makes you think that? The chief asks.
She was pregnant.
You're kidding, the chief says.
Wish I was, Linda says. Very early stages. My guess is she was 6 or 7 weeks along. She might not even have realized it.
Wow, the chief says.
The plot thickens, Linda says.
The chief hangs up and his phone rings again. This time it's the Nantucket Hospital.
This is Ed Kapanash, he says.
Chief, it's Margaret from the ER.
Hey, Margaret, the chief says. What's up?
We have the bride from that wedding, Margaret says. Kind of strange. She says she wants to talk to the police here at the hospital rather than at the house. Her fiancé came to check on her. They had words, then he stormed out.
Keep her there, Margaret, the chief says. I'll send the Greek the instant he's free.
The Greek? Margaret says. My nurses will be thrilled.
The chief smiles for the first time that day.
Thanks, Margaret, he says.
Then he turns into the station. They are holding Shooter Uxley in the first interview room. When the chief enters, Shooter is fast asleep with his head on the table. The chief watches him for a second and listens to him snoring. Whatever anxiety he might be feeling is clearly overridden by exhaustion.
Didn't sleep much last night, buddy? The chief wonders.
Mr. Uxley has taken off his blazer and untucked his shirt. The chief looks at his paperwork. Michael Oscar Uxley. New York driver's license, Manhattan address, West 39th Street. Also from New York City, like the deceased. He wonders if Uxley was the father of Ms. Monaco's baby. The chief nudges his arm.
Hey there, wake up. Mr. Uxley, sir?
Shooter groans and raises his head. He seems disoriented for a second, then he straightens up.
The chief says, In case you've forgotten, I'm Chief Kapanash, Nantucket Police. You put on some nice moves out there.
Shooter blinks.
I want a lawyer, he says.
Thursday, June 22nd to Friday, June 23rd, 2017. Celeste. She doesn't meet Shooter until she and Benji have been together for 9 months. Shooter is Benji's best friend. So why does it take so long? Well, Shooter is busy. He owns and operates a company called A-List, which provides American retreats for foreign businessmen. What this means essentially is that Shooter has made a career, lucrative, Benji says, out of partying. He takes executives from Asian and emerging Eastern European countries and shows these gentlemen, for his clientele is 100% male, an old-fashioned American good time. Much of the work is centered in Manhattan. The executives are fond of the long-established steakhouses, Smith and Walensky, Gallagher's, Peter Luger's. They like the Intrepid and Times Square. They like the clubs, especially the gentlemen's clubs on 12th Avenue. Shooter also spends a lot of time in Las Vegas. He is, Benji says with a straight face, a Vegas regular. He divides his time between the Aria Sky Suites and the Mandarin Oriental. Shooter himself plays only craps. In prep school at St. George's, he ran a late-night dice game, and that was the source of his nickname. You all gambled in high school? Celeste asks Benji. She herself has never been to a casino, but if she went, she would steer clear of the craps table. The name alone.
Shooter made it impossible to resist, Benji says. I always lost, but it was fun.
When Shooter isn't working in Manhattan or Las Vegas, he is at the Kentucky Derby, the Masters, the Super Bowl, the Indy 500, Coachella, or Mardi Gras. He is sunning in South Beach or skiing in Aspen. Wherever you wish you could be on any given weekend, Shooter is there with a group of his executives. On the weekend of June 23rd, however, Shooter is coming to Nantucket with Benji and Celeste. Celeste is excited to finally meet him. She's also glad he's coming because this is Celeste's first time to Nantucket, her first time to any summer resort, and it's her first time spending the weekend with Tag and Greer, Benji's parents. Celeste met Tag and Greer on three previous occasions. The first was a dinner at Bouvette. Then a few weeks later, there was Sunday church at St. James's, followed by dim sum in Chinatown. The third occasion was a dinner at the Winbury's apartment on Park and 70th to celebrate Benji's 28th birthday. The Winbury's are less intimidating than Celeste expected. Tag is gregarious and charismatic. Greer is high-strung and a bit imperious until her second glass of champagne, when she relaxes into someone quite funny and warm. They are wealthy beyond Celeste's wildest imagination, but as she strove to seem cultured and well-bred, they strove to seem down-to-earth, and they all met in the middle. Neither of the elder Winburys flinched when Celeste announced that her father sold suits at the mall, and her mother worked in the gift shop at a crayon factory. Greer asked several questions about Karen's health that revealed her concern without seeming phony or overbearing. They made Celeste feel comfortable. The Winburys made her feel acceptable, which she found a pleasant surprise. Despite this, staying with them for a long weekend on Nantucket is a daunting prospect, and Celeste is glad for Shooter's presence to take some pressure off her. They are leaving late afternoon on Thursday and returning on Sunday evening. Celeste has taken Friday off work, her first vacation in a year and a half. The last time was when she took a week to care for Karen after her double mastectomy. They are flying from JFK on JetBlue. The flight is only 40 minutes long, but it's another source of anxiety for Celeste. She has never been on an airplane. Benji couldn't believe it when she told him. Never been on a plane? She tried to explain to him that she grew up sheltered, more sheltered than the most sheltered person he knows. She knows that sheltered makes it sound like Bruce and Karen were trying to keep Celeste from the evils of the wider world, but the truth was that Bruce and Karen didn't have the money to explore the world beyond their own neat pocket of it. They didn't have relatives in Duluth or St. Louis to visit, and when Celeste came home from school in sixth grade asking to go to Disney World, Bruce arranged for a Saturday excursion to Six Flags in New Jersey. Over spring break in college, when everyone at Miami of Ohio went to Daytona or the Bahamas, Celeste took the bus home to Easton. There had been no junior year abroad. After college, there had been New York City, her job at the zoo, her life right up until meeting Benji. When would she have boarded a plane? Celeste is so concerned about arriving at JFK in a timely fashion that she foregoes public transportation and springs for an Uber from the zoo. It's $102. Celeste ignores the tight knot of dread in her gut as she adds this expense to the many others this weekend away has incurred. She needed a whole new summer wardrobe, two bikinis, a cover-up, three sundresses to wear out at night, shorts and flip-flops, and a straw bag. She needed a pedicure and a fresh haircut. She needed sunscreen and a hostess gift for Greer. What do you get for a woman who has literally everything? Celeste asked Merritt. Bring her really good olive oil, Merritt said. It's more interesting than wine. Celeste bought a $42, gulp, bottle of olive oil at Dean and DeLuca. Transporting the olive oil to Nantucket cost her another $25 in checked bag fees. Celeste goes through airport security, a soul-shredding experience where she has to stand barefoot among strangers and put her drugstore toiletries on display in a clear plastic bag for others to comment on. The woman behind her points to Celeste's Noxzema and says, "I thought they stopped making that in the 80s. As Celeste is walking to the gate, she gets a text from Benji.
Accident on 55th Street. Midtown at a standstill. I may miss the flight. You go. I'll meet you there tomorrow.
Celeste stopped.